I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, Melissa Fletcher Stolce was known around San Antonio for being a hard-working newspaper reporter, frequently covering the most vulnerable communities in San Antonio. But for decades, she was hiding a secret. She kept that secret even from herself, as she was in deep denial until her abuse of alcohol threatened her marriage. Now Fletcher Stolce is telling her story in her memoir, Drunk Love, Marriage Under the Influence. It's a harsh, honest, and frequently funny telling of her journey that explores the depths of her addiction and the redemptive power of love and self-discovery. How has alcohol impacted your life and relationships? Have you tried quitting drinking? How did that impact you and your partner? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When we drink, and we drink a little bit too much, it impacts not just ourselves, but also our loved ones, perhaps especially our loved ones. And if we're able to, you know, hit that rock bottom, scrape along that rock bottom, finally get help, quit drinking, and then those relationships, they need a reset, a reboot, something sometimes they just don't boot back up the way that you would expect. And that's one of the takeaways from the new memoir, Drunk Love, A Marriage Under the Influence by Melissa Fletcher Stolce. Melissa was a longtime reporter for the San Antonio Light and then the Express News, and by many accounts, she was a success at work and at home, but she also had a secret. Melissa, welcome to The Source. Great to have you here.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
So what was your secret?
Well, I was a nightly wine drinker, and the last 5 years of my drinking, I would drink, not every night, but, you know, to the point of slurring and stumbling and, you know, being loud, acting the fool. And my husband and my son were really the only ones who saw it. Like a lot of female alcoholics, I reserved a lot of my heavy drinking at home. So I still looked, you know, great on paper out in the world. But the truth was, especially those last 5 years, you know, my disease was becoming worse. Alcoholism is a progressive disease. It always gets worse. It never gets better. And, you know, so I presented this face to the world, but in my home, I was hurting the two people that I love the most. And, I called them my incidents. And, you know, in the beginning, when I was around 47, is when they started happening. And then over the years, those incidents would get closer and closer together. And, you know, there were times when my husband would get mad. My son at one point cried and begged me to stop drinking. And I would go into the program that I belong to today that we're not going to name because it's anonymous. But I would go, and I'd kind of convince myself, yeah, I have a problem. I am an alcoholic. And then I would talk myself out of that. You know, alcoholism is the disease that tells the sufferer they don't have it. The denial was particularly strong in my case because, again, I still looked great out in the world, but it was the, you know, the things that were happening at home. And I would lie to myself toward the end there. I was, you know, hiding little bottles of wine in the closet, or, you know, I would chug a beer on the way home if I didn't think I could get enough. You know, my husband, Mark, who's a big part of the book, he'd been my drinking buddy since the day that we met when we were in our late 20s. And, you know, for many decades, drinking was a fun part of our lives. And, you know, it was our fun. It was how we fueled our intimacy. You know, he liked to drink as much as I did. But when I turned 47, and it was like a flip switched overnight, and I couldn't handle my buzz anymore. And it mystified both Mark and me because, you know, I'm not a huge person. He's a big guy, and I could always match him drink for drink. But then toward the end, you know, he would stop drinking and I would keep going because I was an alcoholic. You know, it's a disease of more. It's like you have one drink and then you want another one and another one. You know, where most normal drinkers have a drink or two and they're fine. For those of us who have alcohol use disorder, you know, that's a baffling idea. Why would you have one drink?
You know? Yeah, one's too many. 11's not enough.
Exactly. And you know, my quantities, I would go in and out of the program those last 5 years. because I would talk myself back into not being an alcoholic. And I would hear in the rooms of the program, the 12-step program, you know, people drinking a bottle of vodka a day or a 12-pack of beer. And my quantities were never that much, but toward the end, it was like I could get drunker sooner. And, you know, I vowed to my husband and son that I would quit and I would go to the program, that I'd come back out. And what was confusing, David, for me especially, like I said, you know, Mark was my drinking buddy from the get-go. And he'd get mad at me toward the end for slurring and being loud. And then he'd want to drink with me again. So it was very confusing. That was how he enabled me. You know, we hear about enabling. That was how he kind of helped me stay sick for so long. And I don't blame him for that, because he'll admit he was sick too. You know, alcoholics and addicts, we drive the people who love us crazy. And Mark will admit that by the end, you know, he would go in and out of the program for loved ones of alcoholics, which is also anonymous, so we're not going to name it. But so he was going in and out, just like I was going in and out of my program. And it was the cycle we just couldn't escape, you know. I would do okay for a while, and then I would, you know, have an incident, and I'd stop, then I'd start again. It was like this whiplash within the walls of my home. And, you know, my son, my beloved only child, who I swore I was going to, you know, be a great mom to, it caused him so much pain. And, you know, in our program, we go back and we make amends and we don't have regrets for the past. But, you know, I wish that hadn't happened. But it's part of Sam's journey, like it's part of my journey. And we've been able to talk about it, he and I, and he's forgiven me. And both of my relationships have been healed because of the work I've done in recovery and the work my husband did in recovery. And it's really kind of a miracle that you can cause damage and pain, and there's a way out of it, you know. And that's my book, Drunk Love, A Marriage Under the Influence. It's kind of has a double meaning, because it's the influence of my alcoholism and how it hurt my marriage, but also the influence of my sobriety. Because Mark and I thought that once I stopped drinking, all the problems in our marriage would like magically disappear overnight. And that was certainly not the case. You know, we had both gotten very sick, and we had all these sort of sick dynamics that had taken root in our relationship. You know, I was the poor, shame-filled, guilty, drunken wife, and he was the hectoring, scolding, you know, husband. And so we had to really work on all that. You know, we saw a counselor together and individually, and there was a lot of work to be done in that first year of my sobriety. You know, we both hit our programs really hard. But it was rocky. You know, when I was 6 months sober, Mark was talking about separating from me again. You know, when the big thing that got me into rehab was we had gone to see the Jersey Boys in September of 2010 at the Majestic.
At the Majestic, yeah. Right. And there was a lot of booze.
A lot of drinking before, a lot of drinking during. And I had my first major blackout. You know, I had always told myself, because I'd read all the other recovery memoirs, you know, I'd been in and out of the rooms of the program. I thought, if I ever have a blackout, that's really going to be my sign that I'm an alcoholic. Because, like I said, for the decades I drank, I didn't have any of the typical consequences that you think of about alcohol use disorder. DUIs, blackouts, you know, morning drinking, lost jobs, you know, crashed cars, you know, dropped out of school. I built a great life.
Well, you had all these other signs, like you were hiding alcohol.
Yes.
You were lying about your drinking.
Exactly.
And you were drinking every day, mm-hmm. and you would do all these things in order to make sure that you had access to alcohol.
Exactly. And, you know, it's hard to put into words when you're deep in your alcoholism just how terrifying it is to think that you can't drink anymore. You know, Mark would ask me to quit drinking because he wanted a sober wife, when actually he just wanted me to drink the way I used to. He would say, you know, you've got to stop. And it felt like somebody pushing me off a cliff, you know, with no parachute. I was terrified, you know, even though I was keeping up appearances, I was terrified that I'd have to give up my nightly lover, which was wine.
All right. So our phone lines are open. We do want to hear from listeners if they want to talk about their alcohol use and whether or not it's a disorder and how they have been dealing with that, how that's impacted their relationships. If they're looking for help, if they found help, if they want to talk about it, we just want to talk. So if you want to call in, We want to hear it. Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll continue our discussion about the new memoir, Drunk Love, A Marriage Under the Influence, by Melissa Fletcher Stolce, right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio is Melissa Fletcher Stolce. You may recognize her name as a byline that you've seen in the San Antonio Express News, also with The Light. She frequently covered vulnerable communities in San Antonio, homelessness, people who are unhoused, and talking about people showing their individualism, their humanity. But while, decades, she was dealing with the issue of her own alcohol use disorder. And she has written about that, a new memoir called Drunk Love, A Marriage Under the Influence. She does have a book signing coming up that's going to be tomorrow at the Twig.
Yes.
And what time is that?
That's from 5:30 to 7.
So you can do a reading, you do a book signing, you probably have a lot of people who know you from over the years stopping by to pick up a copy. The book comes out
today.
Today is being published today.
Yes, and you can get it, Amazon, Kindle, Simon & Schuster, all the usual
places. It's
going to
be at Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Noble, yes.
So you have a book signing there, right?
I do, on Saturday at 2 o'clock. Just a signing, not a reading.
Okay. Well, all right. Which Barnes & Noble is that?
That's one off San Pedro.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. And let's go to Nicole. Nicole, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So go ahead. You're on the air.
So my question to Melissa is, as the partner of somebody that is going through that disease and struggling, how do you know when the right time is to say enough is enough or to stick it out?
Yeah.
Nicole, thank you for your call. Great question.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's difficult. You know, my husband stuck around those last 5 years until – I say that blackout at the Majestic was the turning point. And, the next day he was, instead of being angry and shouting at me like he would do the morning after my drunk offs, he was completely calm. And he was like, I just can't do this anymore. And he packed a bag and he left. And, I don't know. I don't know if I could give a strict guideline about when is it time, and Mark and I stayed together and we did a lot of work, but I want to add the caveat that sometimes divorce is the only answer. Addiction can cause so much damage in a relationship. I'm not saying that, you got to stick it out no matter what, but a lot of people that are married to or are in relationship with people with alcohol use disorder definitely avail yourself of what's out there, like the 12-step program for loved ones of alcoholics. There's meetings all over town, and that could give you some clarity about when is it time? When is it finally enough? At some point, you've got to have self-preservation for yourself and your kids, because addiction can just take everyone down. But I would recommend counseling, going to programs, whether it's, in the 12-step program or somewhere else. But the more information you get, then you can make that personal decision of, I'm done, I'm finished. And sometimes, like in my case, that was the key that turned the lock. He was finally serious, and I went to rehab like 2 days later, and that's where everything changed for me. I went there and had a series of what I call my divine coincidences, that I was finally able to do step one, which is admitting you're an alcoholic and you're powerless over alcohol and your life has become unmanageable. And if he hadn't left me, I might still be drinking today. So that was a great gift. What I thought was the worst night of my life after the Majestic, in retrospect, was the best night of my life. But this is a personal decision, and you just need to get as much information as you can to determine when is your ending point? When are you finally done? When, maybe that person can get sober and you can salvage your relationship. And there's a lot more work that comes with that. It takes commitment and dedication, but what's on the other side is amazing. I have a marriage today that I never could have dreamed of. We've done so much work on ourselves that still a human marriage. We have our moments, I'm in recovery. I'm not a robot, but it's the great gift that this program has given me. And I can truly say I am grateful that I'm an alcoholic, because, without it and the work around emotional sobriety, I wouldn't be, I have the marriage of my dreams, and my son and I have, he's forgiven me. It's just, there's just so many miracles to be had, but only you can decide, when it's time to make a change.
So let's take another caller, but I want to get the number again, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255, if you want to call in. I do want, one of the objectives of today's program is to let everyone know that you are not alone. You don't have to go through this alone. There are resources, and there are many, many people going through this right now, just like you. And we can all kind of help each other. I mean, who else can we help but each other? That's what we're here for. So let's go to the next caller. Let's go to Ace. And Ace, you're on the air.
Hello, good afternoon. How are y'all doing?
Good. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
So I was sitting here listening. I was getting ready to go do some daily work, and I only caught about 30, 40 seconds of the show. But I tell you what, it was very powerful listening to your story. I'll try not to get too emotional, but...
Me too.
So I'm a disabled veteran. I spent over 20 years in the Air Force, and I retired in 2018. And about a year and a half ago, I made the decision to stop drinking in my life. I got diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. It was my second bout of cancer. First bout was non-Hodgkin's, but this bout was a little more serious, and they found the cancer in one of my lymph nodes, and so I had to have a port implanted in my chest. And I mean, from one day to the next, my life just got flipped upside down. And so when I retired in 2018, my wife and I, we made a conscious decision to go back home here in San Antonio, Texas, and to spend the rest of our life with our grandkids, seeing them live their life, grow up, and be there for them. And I never really considered myself an alcoholic. And I would always tell people, I'm just a social drinker. I have occasional drink every now and then. But as I reflected back in my life, I thought to myself, well, goodness, I've been drinking my whole life. And without any reservation, thinking of what type of effect this would have, not just on my health, but on relationships, marriage, everyday life. And so when I got diagnosed a year and a half ago with cancer, I told my wife, I'm done. This is really the eye opener for me to make the decision to just turn that chapter or close that chapter in my life. And I told her, I said, I'm not going to force you not to drink, but I think internally, I kind of hope that my wife would make that decision with me and say, I'm going to be there with you and I'm going to stop drinking as well. But she didn't. And I reflected more on my life, and I thought, well, when was the first time that I had a drink of alcohol? And I was 12 years old. I'll never forget an uncle of mine giving me a beer. And I could never imagine giving one of my nephews a beer at that age.
Yeah.
And not to say that it was a systemic problem, amongst family life, in our circle, but it was just one of those things that happened, but I never looked back. And then I spent my whole life drinking.
Yeah. Well, Ace, thank you so much for calling in, and good luck to you. Thank you so much. Let me get Melissa's reaction, particularly to the part where he was talking about. He recognized that it was time for him to close the chapter on his drinking life, and he was hoping that his life partner would do the same.
Yeah, Ace, congrats for the decision you made. That's huge. And it's very interesting because, I said Mark and I had been drinking buddies from the very beginning. It was a big part of our relationship.
That's kind of like what dating is all about.
Yeah.
It's like finding, is this person drinking compatible with me?
And he's a New Orleans boy, so he was down to party, and I was down with that. But I went to rehab in 2010 after my big blackout. And when he drove me home from rehab, he's like, I'm going to quit drinking too to support you. And I was like, that's great. That's what I need. Thanks, honey. And then about 6 months into my sobriety, he came home one day and he's like, I was never an alcoholic. I drank a lot because you did, and I shouldn't have to give up drinking because I enjoy it. And boy, let me tell you, I got a big resentment about that. A counselor had told him to quit drinking for a year to support me, and here he was wanting to drink again. And I kind of had a meltdown. I sent an email to my therapist and to my sponsor, just going off on the fact that how dare he drink again, and not support his newly sober wife. And my sponsor finally said to me, you know what, Melissa, your sobriety is between you and your higher power, not you and your husband. And you need to just get over this. And that was a turning point, too, because I realized, you know, we'd go out sometimes with friends drinking, and I realized because of the work I'd done in my program, I could be around other people drinking, I could be around my husband drinking, and still be in a position of safety and neutrality. That's another miracle of this program. You know, time passes on, and come to find out, Mark really didn't like to drink that much without his hectoring wife. And now, you know, I'm 67, he's 66. He doesn't hardly drink at all anymore, not because he's an alcoholic, but because he's old and he feels like crap the next day. But, you know, there's beer in my refrigerator.
Well, then why not quit drinking?
Exactly. Because, you know, he enjoys it a little bit, you know. But we serve alcohol when we have book club, you know, we serve alcohol. There's beer in the fridge right now because he'll have an occasional beer, but it doesn't call my name anymore. I don't even think about it. And that, again, is part of the miracle. There are folks in the program that are never around alcohol. All their friends are in the program. And I respect whatever choice you need to make. But, yeah, Ace, that was a big deal when he started drinking again. I was ready to just sort of go off. But it ended up being okay. I was safe. I was okay with that. And that was, again, another epiphany for me.
And so the marriage, okay, I'm coming up on the break in about 2.5 minutes. So I don't want to give you all, you know, a tough question here, but, you know, so are you good with that? You know, that he has not said, well, I don't really need it anymore. Why not just totally,
you know,
do without?
David, it really doesn't bother me. You know, if he had continued to drink heavily like we drank together, I don't think I could have stayed married to him. I couldn't live with someone who's a heavy drinker. That's just a line I can't cross. But the fact that we went out for Mother's Day yesterday and he had a couple glasses of wine at dinner, and I don't even think about it. You know, sometimes I'll be at a party and somebody's like breathing wine smell in my face. And I'm like, my brain kind of goes, but it passes. So it's a non-issue. That's all I can say. And that's just because of the work that he and I have both done. And again, my higher power, you know, I go to a God-based program, or, you know, God as you understand God. Your higher power can be whatever you want as long as it's not you. You know, God, Buddha.
Right, and that was also a part of the book, yeah. Was you trying to find that lane of tapping into higher power.
Right.
You were basically a non-believer.
Right. You know, I'm a journalist by trade. I'm into facts and evidence. And when I saw a therapist right before I went, she told me to go. I needed to go to rehab. I was a chronic relapser. I'm like, I have a problem with the whole God thing. Because I'd been to meetings and people would talk about God and it was like fingernails on chalk to me. And she was like, you're going to have to find a way around that. And the good thing that I found was that, you know, the program is spiritual. It's not religious. We have no sect, denomination, politics, or creed. God, as you understand God, you don't even have to call your higher power God. You know, for some folks, that's a loaded term. You know, the atheists and agnostics that are in the program, they'll pick the fellowship as their higher power because it just can't be you. It's got to be something bigger than you. And in that case, they call God group of drunks or good orderly direction. You know, the geniuses that created this program back in 1939 knew they needed a big tent to fit as many alcoholics under the spiritual tent as possible. People with faith, people with no faith. And, you know, it's amazing that if they had told me I had to believe in a certain kind of God, I would have been out the door and I'd still be drinking. So anyway.
Yeah. One of the great things about the book, it's very funny. And I know it's geared towards a national audience, but it's very San Antonio.
Yeah.
We, you know, you talk about Fiesta, which is our, you know, drinking to excess festival that we have.
That's right.
We talk about some local locations, you know, Burgundy Woods for those of us who were drinking during the disco era, Broadway 5050, lots of places that.
The Five-O Divo.
Lots of places where many of us have bent the elbow.
You know, and I've been told the book is darkly humorous. I mean, there's a lot of raw, dark stuff in there, but I've been blessed with a sense of humor. I think that's a healing thing, and humor is healing. So I tried to use as much humor, even in the darkness, because I think people learn and respond when something's funny. You know, and it is funny. Some of the crazy stuff we do as alcoholics, I mean, some of it's not funny at all, but, you know, looking back, you can kind of chuckle.
But it's also part of the self-discovery, being able to laugh at yourself.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right, so we're taking a break here. I have Tanya on the board. I'm going to get you on the air when we come back from this break. Our phone lines are open if you want to call in and talk about how alcohol is still a part of your life and what you want to do about that. We can talk about Melissa's journey some more. And any questions you might have about that, give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And the source is going to continue after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Drunk Love, A Marriage Under the Influence. It's a memoir written by Melissa Fletcher Stolce. She's a longtime reporter, journalist at the local newspaper, the Express News, and also at The Light. And she also worked at the Houston Chronicle, award-winning journalist. And she's here talking about her journey to sobriety and how she was able to, I guess, barely hang on to your marriage. Is that the right word?
By hook or by crook.
it's a challenge.
It was just a challenge.
Because you stop drinking doesn't mean everything is going to suddenly fall into place. It's going to take a whole new set of efforts.
Yeah, and we had to address not only the sick dynamics that my disease brought up, but even dynamics that predated my illness. And, we had to find a whole new way to be together with me not drinking. All of our friends that still drank,
I want to go to a caller. We have Tanya, and then after we're going to go to Matthew, but let's go to Tanya first. Tanya, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Well, great. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Go ahead.
All right. So I am a soon-to-be ex-spouse of a recovering alcoholic. So I agree with our guest here that sometimes, divorce is the way it goes. I mean, it's not the only issue, but the heavy drinking did contribute. And when you guys were mentioning, drinking compatibility, there was an incompatibility. I am not much of a drinker, like maybe a serving of wine per month with, my family at that family gatherings or whatnot. But my ex, he had very extensive collections, bourbons and whiskeys. And at one point he did realize, it was a problem when he would get depressed and start drinking, say 12 servings of bourbon or whiskey at home alone in his office, and this would happen regularly. When I really did start noticing the problem the last couple of years when he would go out drinking and we're with my family and there would be a tequila, there would be beer, there would be wine, and he would be driving me and our child home in not a sober state at all. My main question with this, besides agreeing that sometimes divorce is the answer, is how did you face enablers? In my case, it was my family that knew he loved, whiskeys and bourbons and would gift that to him. And at, always going over to my family's house, he would wind up getting a Shiner or two or three. And at one point was raiding my mom's pantry for alcohol. Mm-hmm. They didn't see it as a problem. And how do you deal with people who don't see the problem at all and know a person's penchant for certain alcohols or liquors and continue to gift them that and continue to enable the habit?
All right, Tanya, thank you for that great call and good luck to you as you move forward. So there is that issue. Okay, you say you call your husband was – he was, being rude to you, mean to you, telling you not to drink, but at the same time, he was enabling you. Mm-hmm. We have a society which is an enabling society. Mm-hmm. So how do we work all that out?
Yeah, I feel for her. That's a really difficult struggle that she's been going through, and my husband, we think of classic enabling as the spouse that calls the boss and says, my husband's sick or my wife is sick, when actually, it's a hangover. My husband didn't really have the classic sort of enabling, maybe because I didn't require it that much. But again, like I said, he would get mad at me for slurring and stumbling. And then within a week or sometimes 3 days, he was drinking with me again. You know, my family, my mother had married two different alcoholics, and so she, you know, she got involved in the she had a black belt, she called it, in the program for loved ones. And she, a few times she would say to me, you know, your father was an alcoholic. You girls have to be careful. I have two sisters. I'm the only one that became an alcoholic. But my family didn't really see what was going on with me. I kept it pretty well hidden. But yeah, when you've got family members that, you know, can see that someone's got a problem and they're still like pouring on the alcohol, you know, I don't know what's, you know, how you can handle that. And your husband or ex-husband, you said depression. A lot of people with alcoholism have what they call comorbidities, right? They have underlying mental health issues. Like I had a lifetime struggle with anxiety and panic attacks. And it's, you know, until he stops drinking, if that happens, he won't be able to really, really address some of his underlying issues. But I feel for you. You're kind of outnumbered. And again, like David said, we live in a drinking society. TV, movies, everywhere you look. I mean, women and wine have almost become synonymous in our culture.
What's reality TV?
Right.
Oh,
you know, big
like
goblets of red wine. Yeah.
Dysfunctional individuals.
Right. Throwing
it
at each
other. Do you want to be that?
Yeah. You know, just take care of yourself. And, you know, like I say, if you want to go to a program or get a counselor, you got to take care of yourself because you can't change him. The hard part about this disease is you've got to diagnose yourself. You can't argue anybody into sobriety. It just doesn't work.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a quick question and I want to get to Matthew, but really quickly, I mean, so enabling, well, then what is the proper thing to do? Do you call up the boss and say, my wife can't go to work today because she's hungover? Do you refuse to, you know, go out and buy the bottle of booze for her? What do you do?
Well, you know, there's the whole concept of tough love, right, for
or
loved ones.
Until it doesn't work.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, and there's also the thought that the alcoholic can never get that gift of desperation until they are left to their own consequences. You know, I didn't go to rehab until Mark packed a suitcase and left me after that fateful night at the Atlanta, at the Majestic. So, you know, it sounds mean and unloving, but to let them feel and experience their own consequences, that could be the turning point. Or maybe not. They may never get sober. You know, the vast majority of...
And then they just blame you. I mean,
they blame
the people,
you.
Alcoholics are expert blamers.
Any excuse to drink. You made me drink, you know.
Yeah, and that's, it's your fault. You're a drinker too, you know.
That's pure BS.
All right, I want to go to Matthew. And Matthew, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about survivor's guilt. Maybe not a question, just more of a comment. Just, yeah, survivor's guilt's always been kind of weird, I guess, because I've lost a couple people really close to me, my dad being one, a couple friends, and not even necessarily just surviving as far as being, you know, as far as survivor's guilt being alive, but also just, I mean, I've been completely, I'm well aware of how fortunate I've been. I've never lost a job. I've kept my friends. You know, I'm 5 years clean, alcohol free as of now. But you know, before it was all day, every day, and it was a challenge, of course. But now that, you know, 5 years out, it's kind of strange looking around and seeing the friends and things that have lost and being in and out of the meetings as well, listening to people's stories and all the things that other people have lost. And I look at myself and I feel, of course, very fortunate in not having lost those things, but I do have that sense of guilt for sure, just having listened to these people and their stories, and some of them are really, you know, they're really heart-wrenching. And I just want to know if that's sort of a normal feeling, because having been 5 years, I guess, is not a long time, relatively speaking, I guess.
It's a long time.
Sure it is.
Yeah.
It feels good to be that far out, but I mean, again, I still, you know, work to do and things like that. But just guilt is something that I feel pretty constantly as far as, you know, going into meetings and hearing people's stories and things. And I just need to know if that's kind of normal,
sure.
I guess.
Yeah.
Well, Recovery Village reports that it says that individuals who maintain sobriety for 5 years have a relapse chance of 15%.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's not 100%, you know, it's not zero, but that's really, really good. So, yeah, you have something to be proud of. But this, Melissa, what about survivor's guilt? Like, I managed to do it, but my friend didn't, and now he's gone. Or right. how do you negotiate that?
Yeah, you know, I haven't really heard the term survivor's guilt in this context, but certainly, you know, I've sponsored lots of women, and some of them, you know, they go away, they don't stick with it. You know, I think a lot of folks, for whatever reason, the spiritual solution is not for them, the 12 steps. And in that case, you know, try something else. But, you know, I think you have to just realize that addiction is a horrible, fatal, progressive disease. And, you know, in the program, we say alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it's too much for us. And I think you just have to realize, I guess, not everyone can be saved. And, you know, self-preservation, again, it's a theme I keep hitting. You've got to take care of yourself, and you can't feel bad that for whatever reason some folks don't get it. You know, it's a mystery why some people, you know, find the spiritual solution and so many don't. But, you can hear very hard things. And I would go to meetings, and I would, before I got sober, and I'd listen to the differences and not the similarities. I'm like, man, this has not happened to me. I'm not that bad. Well, you know, you don't have to take the elevator all the way down to the basement to claim your chair in recovery or any other kind of, you know, treatment modality. But yeah, this is a terrible disease, and we don't talk about it enough in our culture. You know, it's really, you know, the image is all one of conviviality and fun and partying, and there's such a dark side to alcohol. And, you know, the science is coming out showing that even moderate use can be problematic. You know, it's a toxin. But again, you know, I don't judge. I don't judge people who leave their marriages over addiction. I don't judge people that, for whatever reason, relapse. I mean, the program I'm in is a safe place. It's a judgment-free zone. And, you know, this disease is just, it's horrible. It's stronger than so many other things.
I got to take this break, but really, really quickly, do you recommend somebody try a program, go to one of these places, go to a meeting?
Yeah, try something. You know, addiction is all about isolation and disconnection. And whether you join a 12-step program or some other kind of help group, you know, we heal in community. We don't heal in isolation. So it's critical to find your tribe.
Right. Okay, we're taking a break here. Our phone lines, give us a call. We want to talk about alcoholism, addiction, 833-877-8255, how it's impacted you, how it's impacted your family, and how you want others to see this. And we're going to come back with Lawrence. We'll get Lawrence on the air. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the memoir Drunk Love, A Marriage Under the Influence, with Melissa Fletcher-Stolce, a former reporter in San Antonio. And her memoir is gripping. It's funny. It's also dark, but it's very informative. But I got to ask you, Melissa, about you know, the tough question. This is something that a lot of people talk about when you go to like these meetings. How much did you drink?
So toward the end, last 5 years or so, in the beginning, I could drink a glass or two of wine and get a nice little feeling. But toward the end, my tolerance had changed. I would have to drink four drinks, like a bottle of wine, and then I would want more. So I would rush in with, you know, if my husband's watching TV, and I might maybe, you know, chug more wine, or if there's vodka in the freezer, chug some of that. Which, you know, if you go to meetings, that doesn't sound like that much. But what I discovered when I came out of rehab, they tell you in rehab, go to the doctor and get a full clean bill of health. So I did that. And by that point, I hadn't had a drink in maybe 2 months. And my liver enzymes came back through the roof. And I went to see the doctor when he told me about that. I'm like, am I in danger? Would I have been in danger of developing cirrhosis? And he says, you may have that, some of that going on already. And you could have knocked me over with a feather. I thought with the, you know, the comparatively smaller amounts that I drank compared to, you know, alcoholics in the rooms, there'd be no physical consequences. But what we know is that women's bodies are far more devastatingly impacted than men's bodies. You know, it takes a lot less to hurt us alcohol-wise than it does for men. And that's because of, you know, our fat distribution, and, you know, we have less muscle tissue. So, you know, the good thing was my doctor said, you keep not drinking, and sometimes the liver can heal itself. I came back in 6 months later, and everything was back to normal. And we, you know, we both high-fived each other. But it's like, too much liver damage, and the liver can't rejuvenate, and that's why people die of things like cirrhosis. But you know, if I hadn't gone to rehab and had my big moment of honesty and clarity that I really am an alcoholic, I would have kept drinking, and I may, in fact, have died from this disease. You know, little old, you know, bottle of wine and two drinks, Melissa. It could have been very, very painful and a horrible way to die.
So recovery from alcohol use disorder is a nonlinear process. People think, you know, I'm going to go on this journey and it is a, you know, straight line. Mm-hmm. But actually, it is a lot of detours, a lot of false starts, a lot of dead ends. Mm-hmm. You know, what should people expect if they say, I want to stop drinking? Mm-hmm. What will my recovery look like?
Right. So, yeah, my first year of recovery, the line was going up, but there were valleys, ups and downs, right, as I tried to negotiate, you know, this new sober life I was living with my husband. And, you know, it takes what it takes. And, you know, you get out of it what you put into it, right? I jumped in with both feet. You know, I was ready to be sober. I was like a sponge. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I did everything that was suggested to me. I'll, you know, worked the steps with the sponsor. And, you know, we have these things called the promises in the program. It's, you know, you find yourself living happy, joyous, and free. You know, you give up on the pain of the past. You move beyond it. But that happens sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. There are people that it takes, you know, quite a while to start getting the benefits of sobriety. They are there, but you have to work for them, and you've got to be steadfast.
Okay, I'm going to go to Lawrence, and our number is 833-877-8255. And Lawrence, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You sound great.
Okay, thank you. I just recently quit drinking, and I've drank most of my life. I'm a combat veteran, Marine Corps vet, Iraq. Mm-hmm. And I did come back with some issues, and especially in the military, drinking is kind of a way of life. Especially more so when I came back, just because it's kind of a way to escape.
Mm-hmm.
So now that I quit drinking, I kind of feel like I'm finding myself again. You know, I've always been this one person. And now, you know, just finding out who I am, you know, and just the times that, you know, I always knew I did something stupid because I'd wake up in the morning and it'd be like, man, I feel like a jerk. You know, you don't quite know what you did, but you know you did something stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And just to kind of, you know, move on now. And I've noticed now, like, smells and certain things come back to me, you know, that I have a smell and it kind of, you know, take me back to Iraq.
Mm.
And those have come back. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but, you know, I'm dealing with it.
Wow.
You know, so. Mm.
Well, yeah. Lawrence, thank you so much. Good luck to you. I think you're on the right path. Thank you for calling in. So those triggers. So obviously, Lawrence, I mean, he went through it in the military in Iraq, and that was, you know, amazing and tough and hard. But also, okay, so I hate to make this comparison because it's not appropriate, but working in journalism, there's a lot of pressure, a lot of deadlines, a lot of expectations. People want you to do something spectacular and then do it again. Mm-hmm. So was that also something that you had to wrestle with?
Yeah, and, you know, Lawrence, congrats to you for making this incredibly important change. And, you know, I never got PTSD from any. I did do some pretty dark stories, but certainly can't compare what, you know, what Lawrence went through. But yeah, you know, in the journalism field, you're only as good as your last story. So there was a lot of pressure to be on, to produce. And, you know, I never lost a job because of my drinking, but those last couple of years, 3 years, I had really kind of checked out. I mean, I hit my deadlines. I was productive, but I lost my passion, you know, for writing. And the great thing is, and Lawrence, you'll hopefully find this, that when you're sober for a while, you know, those triggers lessen, hopefully, but the small pleasures, like for me, a good cup of coffee in the morning, you know, we talk about the big spiritual pluses from recovery, but that, you know, life becomes pleasurable again. When I quit drinking, I thought, how am I ever going to have fun? You know, how do you go to a Mexican restaurant and not get trashed on margaritas? You know, how do you go to a wedding and not drink champagne? And I want to tell the listeners, there is life after recovery. And this is a big, beautiful, abundant world, and you will have pleasure.
Yeah, because that seems to be the big question that a lot of people have is like, I don't know who I am if I don't drink.
Right. Exactly.
And so what do you tell those people with that question?
Well, and you know, it's What I found in my recovery, it's like peeling the onion skin. You know, we do a lot of work on steps, but I feel like at this late stage of my life, I'm living a more authentic life. I know that word's used a lot, but I feel like I'm able to take the mask off and be who I really am, who God really wants me to be. And, you know, it's kind of amazing that that's one of the benefits. You know, you think you're just going to stop drinking, but there's just so much more to it. And, yeah, I just the people that drink a lot, people who are alcoholics, we surround ourselves with other drinkers. And I lost some friends after recovery, but I still have a lot of friends, and they drink moderately. But, yeah, you'd have to change a lot, people, friends, places, and things. You know, I can go anywhere because my program is one of freedom. Probably would never go to a wine tasting.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is recovery is about authenticity, freedom, living your true self. And when you remove that static of alcohol, you get that flow of who, you know, you're really meant to be. And it's just such a big thing. It's so much more than just not drinking.
What was your biggest surprise about writing this book when you wrote it and you put it out there? Any big surprises?
Well, you know, nobody's really read it yet. It just comes out today. But I keep, you know, I put post stuff on Facebook and people are like, oh, you're so courageous to put your story out there. You know, I guess. But it's like, David,
I mean, it's pretty raw.
It's pretty raw. There's some pretty raw stuff. But I don't have any shame about being in remission from a fatal and progressive disease. I had a lot of shame when I was drinking. My shame was a toad that was on my chest just about every morning I woke up. But, you know, something...
Like when Lawrence mentioned that.
Yes, yeah. But like my recovery, I put it up there with my marriage and the birth of my son. This is one of the best things that's ever happened to me. Why would I want to hide that light under a bushel, you know? And so I'm not, maybe I'll feel shame if I start getting negative reactions. Maybe I just won't read them. But, you know, this is all good. And I'm, you know, I just feel like if my book can help one woman or one man, one family member of a loved one with alcoholism, then my job is done. You know,
it's not. I mean, that's not enough. One is not enough. Let's shoot for more than that.
Well, yeah. Trying to be modest, David.
So, but who did you write for? Who were you thinking of when you wrote the book?
Well, you know, like I said, I read all the recovery memoirs even when I was still drinking. And, you know, I got the idea to write this in rehab. I felt like there's a void here. So I want to write particularly for the woman who drank like I did, who maybe could keep it all together to the outside world, but is trapped in denial.
Think it's harder for women?
I think it's harder for women. I mean, there's stereotypes. You know, there's more male alcoholics than females, although those numbers are changing. But yeah, I think that, there's a stereotype. And I just, I want to help somebody that doesn't have to stay sick as long as I did. You know, I was sick for 5 long years, and it could have been so much shorter, but I didn't feel like I heard my story often. You know, again, I was listening for the differences. And once I got sober, here's the irony. I go to meetings now, and everything I hear makes sense to me. You know, it's like you have to open your mind and your heart. So really, I hope lots of people, like loved ones of alcoholics, read my book. Therapists maybe could provide it to their clients. But particularly women who drank like I did, you know, that could say, wait a minute, I'm not an alcoholic. I've never woken up in a stranger's bed. Well, sorry. You don't have to ride the elevator all the way down, friend.
So. Right, but that's just part of the, you know, the negotiation that people have. They mm-hmm. say, well, I wasn't that kind of alcoholic, but
right.
I think that anyone who has that dependency, even if you're not doing blackout drunk,
right.
if it's interfering with the life that you want to have, then you have to figure this out.
Right. The doctors, the medical community says alcohol use disorder is the continued use of a substance despite negative consequences. That's it, right? You can go on the DSM-5 and find, you know, the 11 different symptoms. But I think that those tests they tell you that you can take online, am I an alcoholic? I took those all the time. They should add a question. Do you take online alcoholism tests regularly?
Right. If you think you might be, then
you might be.
Are.
Right. If you think you have a problem, you probably do.
Well, Melissa Fletcher-Stolce, thank you so much for coming on today. The new book, the memoir, Drunk Love, A Marriage Under the Influence, it is out today. You have a book signing tomorrow at the Twig, and it is from 5 to 7. Mm-hmm. And come out and buy a book and say howdy and get it signed and share your story. This is something we do need to talk about. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem is being silent.
Exactly, exactly. Thanks so much, David, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for coming on. And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.